From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we take a look at news and events in the Latin America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
I think it's probably quite important to have another look at what we were talking about the last time we spoke, which is the general uncertainty in the region in relation to the new presidency in the United States of Donald Trump and what that may or may not mean in terms of a change in policy towards the region. And over the last couple of weeks, ever since Trump took office on January the 20th, and it seems to me it's become quite clear that in quite important areas of foreign policy, there's unlikely to be much significant change. And I think that's probably true about Latin America as well. Apart from the main big change is the dramatic deterioration in relations with Mexico.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. You know, let's see how that eventually pans out. If Donald Trump does renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico, then that will be a very important indicator for the rest of the region about what they can expect from U.S. trade policy generally. But the important thing to remember is that despite the fact that China has displaced the United States as the main exporter to several countries, including countries like Brazil, and is becoming increasingly more important to Mexico, the United States does remain the probably the first or second or third, most for most countries in Latin America, most important trading partner. And that's I don't think that's going to change in the short term, principally for geographic reasons, apart from all the political heritage and political economic heritage of the century and a half of United States imperialism and neocolonialism, and the hold that they still maintain on the region in economic and commercial and in particular financial terms. But and look, if you start looking across the region, there's a lot of uncertainty, and all this talk that you and I have been quite skeptical about over the last year or so about a conservative restoration and remains extremely speculative. Because if you look at Argentina, and a year and a bit into the government of Mauricio Macri, Cristina Kirchner is leading the polls for the elections to the legislature. There are legislative elections at the end of this year, and she's leading the polls with her colleagues from the Front for Victory, the Frente por la Victoria in Argentina, by a mile. And so, and that's a good indicator of the way opinion in Argentina, which was very, very polarized in those last elections that were national elections that were won by Macri. And he only won by about something like 2%, something like that. And so that polarization looks as though it's going to change, and people will see it when the elections eventually happen.
This comes after, they were doing a massive public relations campaign against her, trying to tie her to corruption and all of that, and apparently she's weathered that pretty well too, huh?
Well, yeah, but that's ongoing, and that's part of the uncertainty. What's going to happen with this completely vicious and corrupt trial that the authorities have under the leadership of Mauricio Macri and his cronies have engineered against Cristina Kirchner and her family. They're not just going after Cristina, they're going after her whole family, including her mother.
Yep.
You know, and it's just, it's really vindictive, and I think it's going to backfire on them spectacularly in the 2017 elections. But that's all part of the uncertainty, the swings and roundabouts, ups and downs of politics in the region. And if you look at what's happened in Brazil, there was a massive outpouring of sympathy for Lula da Silva when his wife died last week. because apparently as a result of something similar to a stroke that she suffered back in last month in January, I think, and she died. And there's a lot of speculation that she was very badly affected by the vicious campaign attacking Ignacio Lula da Silva, the former president, Workers' Party president of Brazil, led by the right wing, who are completely corrupt. And an indication of their corruption was that the presidential candidate, Aécio Neves, who ran against Dilma Rousseff back in, whenever it was, it seems like ancient history now, in 2014, 2015. He's now caught up in this a continent-wide corruption scandal involving the one of the world's leading engineering companies, the brilliant Brazilian company Odebrecht, which has been caught up in scandal after scandal, and now one of the leading players involved in that scandal, who's facing a long period of jail time, has fingered Aécio Neves as his accomplice. And so that, you know, that's another indication of how completely corrupt the Brazilian right wing and the regional right wing in general, but in particular the Brazilian right wing. And that's contributing to all the uncertainty. But this outpouring of sympathy for Lula indicates that the corrupt right wing authorities in Brazil will have to tread very carefully if they do decide to continue going after him on the basis of no evidence at all. So there's and I think this theme of uncertainty, Don, is going to continue for. And at least until the outcome, the final outcome of the Ecuadorian elections are decided. Now, in my opinion, Ecuador and Nicaragua are two kind of weather vane countries, if you like. And they give us some indication of the direction in which, how far can the progressive policies that have completely transformed Latin America and the Caribbean over the last 15 years, how far can they continue to be successful in this current climate of uncertainty? And we're going to find out when the first round of the elections take place in Ecuador. It's possible that President Rafael Correa, who has decided not to stand as a candidate in these national elections in Ecuador. I think they're on the 19th. His former government colleague, Lenín Moreno, a guy with disability, apparently a very talented and a very popular politician, and he's way ahead in the polls, but it's an open question of whether he can win on the first round. And there again, the right wing are playing a very dirty game. They're trying to involve Moreno's vice presidential candidate, a guy called Jorge Glass, in the Odebrecht scandal that has very many different dimensions across the region. And it has a dimension in Ecuador. And the opposition in Ecuador are trying to link Lenin Moreno's vice presidential candidate Jorge Glass to that scandal, but that again is likely to backfire on them because Jorge Glass is a very highly regarded politician in Ecuador, and we'll see what happens on the first round. If Moreno wins on the first round, and that'll be a very decisive message in political terms for the region that the progressive governments and their policies continue to be the leading driving force of change in Latin America. if he goes to a second round, and he's still likely to win, but it's likely to be a closer closer contest in the second round, because the opposition will unite, of course, in an attempt to defeat him. But it looks as though he's still likely to win even on the second round. So, and that's very, very positive for the region. Because if you think about it, what would happen if the right wing won? Well, they'd immediately align with Peru, Chile, Colombia, Mexico, in the so-called Pacific Alliance, which is an attempt at regional integration dominated by the interests of regional corporations and their foreign allies. And that would be a serious defeat for the regional integration processes based on solidarity, complementarity, cooperation,
right,
of which the ALBA countries currently, Bolivia, Cuba, Ecuador, Nicaragua, Venezuela, of course, they're the most important countries, plus various Caribbean island nations, I mean, Dominica, Antigua and Barbuda, the St. Kitts and the Grenadines, I think. And that block of countries has been very, very important in largely under the inspiration of much lamented Comandante Eterno Hugo Chavez and now our much lamented Comandante Fidel. And they're no longer here, but they were the intellectual architects of the regional integration based on solidarity and cooperation that minimizes ideological differences. And that policy has been extremely successful. But the right-wing policies tends to negate that, obviously. And so those elections in Ecuador are going to be absolutely crucial for the direction that the region takes in very, very broad ideological terms, so probably over the next 10 years.
And it's interesting, too. I mean, they've got they elect a new National Assembly at the same time, and then they've got this sort of tax referendum too, like this tax haven referendum that's up, which would ban politicians and civil servants from having bank accounts or companies based in tax havens. I guess that was in reply to that whole thing that happened with the Panama Papers or whatever.
Right, and that's another reason why the election in Ecuador is so important, because Ecuador this year is has the temporary presidency of the UN Group of 77 countries plus China. And when Rafael Correa, in his speech, I think it's about almost a month ago now, when he accepted that, in his acceptance speech, when Ecuador took over that pro-tempore presidency of that very, very important block of majority world countries in the United Nations, he was very clear about the agenda, climate justice, justice in at an international level in every aspect, including financial trade justice, and the elimination of these fiscal paradises, these tax havens, that enable many billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of money that's illicitly extracted one way or another from majority world countries, and put at the service of the global corporate elites who run the financial and commercial system that's still currently dominated by the United States and its European allies. So, the other important point about Ecuador is that it also has the pro-tempore. Oh no, it's just handed on the pro-tempore presidency of CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, to El Salvador, but it remains part of the group of three countries that represent the CELAC region, the CELAC body, in international talks, for example, with the Russian Federation or China, with the European Union. So, whoever wins the election in Ecuador will have a key role this year, not just at a regional level, but also at an international level in the UN.
So, let's spin this to Nicaragua, because you have both what happens in Ecuador is very important and as a bellwether, but also what just happened in Nicaragua is pretty important as a bellwether as well.
Yeah, because Daniel Ortega won it was a truly personal and political triumph for Daniel Ortega and the FSLN, because despite the best efforts of the opposition to try and claim that the November elections were phony and a fraud, and he won with a massive majority. And it's true that there was a slight drop in attendance, but nothing like what the in participation in the elections. And normally in Nicaraguan elections, participation is up around 72-73% voter participation, and this year it was down around 62%, something like that. But largely because of apathy, because people were convinced that Daniel Ortega was going to win. And although there was an opposition campaign to try and discredit the elections, and that fell completely flat, certainly at a domestic level, and Daniel Ortega won again and I think he won this time with 70% of the vote. They increased their number of legislators in the National Assembly by 2 or 3. And so they still have a sufficient majority to change the constitution if they wanted to. But they've made very clear ever since the 2011 elections that they want a consensus-based, dialogue-based policy program involving the whole of Nicaraguan society, and they've lived up to that. And that is why in election after election, Daniel Ortega wins. But he wins with a set of policies that are biased towards a socialist-inspired agenda. And so, and what are the examples of that? The examples of that that spring to my mind are Nicaragua's the only country that I'm aware of that refused to sign the Paris Climate Accord, which, because it's non-binding, is completely meaningless. And if you read reports in even in the mainstream corporate press, even the mainstream corporate press now recognizes that the Paris Climate Accord is not going to stop temperatures rising in some areas by as much as 4 degrees centigrade over the next 5 to 10 years. And that is disastrous. That is a disastrous change in the climate affecting extremely vulnerable low-income countries in the majority world. Yeah. Nicaragua is the only country that stood out against the Paris Accord, and since the Paris Accord, it's gradually been gathering support for its position, which is that the big industrialized country polluters have to cut their emissions. And there has to be some kind of climate justice component to recompense vulnerable countries that are suffering as a result of pollution from the big industrial economy.
Yeah, and the treaty has to actually be enforceable, which is the acrimony with which this is discussed in politics in the United States is hilarious when you consider the fact that it's not binding.
Right. So there's that, and another interesting thing that happened recently is that yesterday, I think it was yesterday morning, there was a meeting of the UN Working Group on Palestine in Managua, and Nicaragua made very clear its position, demanding that Palestine cease its occupation. Israel ceases its occupation of the Palestinian territories. And it implements the international agreements in the UN in relation to Palestine. That currently Israel is violating in the most flagrant way by planning for another, I think it's another 3,000 illegal settlements in Palestine. And so in that area, Nicaragua is also a leading country in trying to promote the framework of international law, and in that they share that aspiration with many other countries in the world. In particular, that's an important argument, one of the key arguments of Sergei Lavrov and the Russian Federation when he represents the Russian Federation, this insistence on international law as it developed since 1945, that the United States and its allies have just thrown out of the, they just trash it every opportunity they get. So that, and that, in that sense, Nicaragua's also playing a key role in the region, defending the role of international law. And another thing that happened just over the last week that's very, very important in economic and commercial terms is that Nicaragua's cooperative movement, in which the country's transport industry, including taxi drivers, is organized, managed to successfully lobby against the introduction of the Uber car ride service that is that has devastated taxi businesses elsewhere in the world. And I'm not entirely familiar with how strong Uber is in the United States and elsewhere.
Well, since you bring that up, let me just tell you what I saw. This was at the Democratic National Convention and not at the Republican National Convention. In each case, they had set up security zones around the basketball arena where the convention was held, the one in Cleveland and one in Philadelphia. And that involved fences about a mile from the site in a circumference around it. Okay, you had to walk a mile once you got through metal detectors, the Secret Service, Department of Homeland Security, and myriad of other characters. So that meant that your taxi, from your hotel or whatever, had to drop you a mile from the site. Except at the Democratic National Convention, if you took Uber, they could drive you right to the facility. And when you were leaving, you could either walk that mile. Now we're talking mid-late July. It was at like 1,000 degrees and all of that. Except for the air-conditioned tent that Uber was allowed to set up for people to wait for and call Uber. In other words, and the taxi drivers in Philadelphia were furious with the mayor and the city council, all Democratic, for basically screwing the taxi business out of this thing that was the most important event in Philadelphia in a number of years. This was going to be a big boom to their business, and instead they handed it to Uber.
So yeah, and Uber suffered a serious defeat. Now they're going to continue trying to establish themselves in Central America, and I think I'm not sure how far they've got in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. But they're currently in Costa Rica. There's a big controversy, and the taxi drivers in Costa Rica nationally are lobbying against the introduction of Uber's model into the Costa Rican economy. But they're going to keep doing it. It's very clear, and I don't understand why people are confused about Uber, because they are a classic capitalist operation. They're trying to establish a monopoly in their industry, yep. And once they've established their monopoly, they're going to drop the benefits that the customers and people working for them enjoy. And it's just as clear as day. And what that's... For some reason, that's in the United States, organized transport industry, taxi drivers have been unable to effectively combat Uber. But in Nicaragua, perhaps because it's such a small country, only 6.5 million people, something like that, and in our economy here in Nicaragua, what's called the associative economy, the cooperative economy, is very, very strong, and it dominates huge swathes of Nicaragua's economic and commercial life. For example, the food industry, the taxi industry, the bus industry, the public transport in general. And so the cooperative movement is very, very important for a huge percentage of the population. I think, let me see if I can remember the figures. And I think that 70% of the economically active population are engaged in the associative and cooperative economy. And they produce, depending on how you measure GDP, if you measure it by income, they produce something like 60% of GDP. And if you measure it by production, they produce something like 52, 53% of GDP.
So
it's they're very, very important. It's a very, very important economic block that the government cannot abuse, or even if they were so inclined, and they're not so inclined. The government here knows that they depend on that economic reality for their political support. That's why Daniel Ortega has popularity levels up around 80%, and why he keeps winning elections with around 70% of the vote.
He does some other things too, in terms of international politics or whatever. For example, it was 2 years ago, I think, at CELAC, he had Puerto Rican independistas, front and center. Another CELAC meeting a few years earlier, he gave Mel Zelaya, front and center position in his stead. You know, he's got, in terms of solidarity with the various independence movements and anti-hegemonic activity, he's like right there all the time.
Yeah, and that solidarity is the key word there, because that is what characterizes Nicaragua's domestic and international policy. And that is why, in the same way that Ecuador and what happens in Ecuador is currently so very, very important for the region, and over the next few years, Bolivia will come to play a similar role as the elections draw closer in Bolivia. And certainly in Central America and the Caribbean, Nicaragua's role as a kind of a policy lighthouse, if you like, illuminating the region, is absolutely crucial. And hardly anybody outside the region actually understands that. People outside Central America don't understand it. And if you read The Guardian or The Washington Post or New York Times or any of these kind of right-wing liberal media, and the imperialist propaganda machine, even they are having to recognize that Nicaragua stands out as an extraordinary success story in the fight against organized crime, and also in maintaining social stability in a way that prevents large numbers of the population emigrating. And there's a very prestigious opinion poll company here in Nicaragua called Consultores MEIRE, M&R Consultants. And they, every 4 months, they do a systematic study of views and opinions in Nicaragua. And their last report was published in mid-January, covering the people's opinion in December of last year. And what they found was that the number of people who might think about immigrating has dropped to around 30%, which sounds like a lot. But in historical comparisons, it's half of what it was 10 or 12 years ago. And that is why so few Nicaraguans figure among the enormous wave of people seeking to escape the violence and economic instability prevalent in Guatemala, Honduras, and still in El Salvador. And so, although the corporate media and a lot of the alternative media in North America and Europe refuse to recognize it, on all kinds of levels, Nicaragua is an outstanding policy model, economically, environmentally, in terms of international politics, in terms of its commercial policies in favor of the low-income majority. And it stands out as an absolute beacon of sanity and successful policy in a region that is racked by insecurity and violence and corruption.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. thanks for listening.